This past week, I was driving north on the four-lane highway from the south end of town to the north end of town. And if you can imagine the part of road where you're coming north, it's right before the Essa Road exit. So you're kind of up on a higher, you know, hill. And you're looking down, and you can basically see like a kilometer of road in front of you. And as I was cresting the hill, all of a sudden, I could see all these brake lights coming on. Right? Oh, traffic was starting to back up. I think I could see some ambulance lights on the horizon, right? Oh, no. And people started to like take a 45-degree angle to get off the highway, right? Because they wanted to get out from around it. And I thought, I can probably get to where I want to go by snaking through town. So maybe I should do the same thing. You know, the exit's right there. And so I looked in my, you know, blind spot, hit the blinker and got off just in time, right? Trouble ahead, better go around. And the reason I start like this today is because sometimes we can deal with tough, difficult biblical passages like that. We come across a biblical passage, we scan ahead in the text, oh, brake lights, trouble ahead, best to go around. And we skip these passages or just kind of give them a cursory reading, and maybe it's something about being forgiving, the necessity of forgiveness, and we're dealing with a very difficult situation. Maybe it's about a passage about sexual holiness. Maybe it's a passage about bloodshed in Canaan. Oh, we don't like that. You know, brake lights, best go around. But in this church, we have a commitment to deal with difficult passages, not avoid them. And so that is what we are going to do today. It's interesting, a little while ago, I was preaching on Daniel 10. The sermon was called Welcome to the War. It was about high-ranking demonic entities and spiritual warfare. So that came out on the podcast one week. That same week, I released a blog and an episode called Three Things That Married Christian Men Should Pray For, right? Three prayers for married Christian men, and it was about wanting to be godly men and having eyes that were only for our wives and being faithful examples to our children. But I don't know, there's something about that same week where there's a podcast released on spiritual warfare and something about prayers that married Christian men should say. That week was the single biggest drop in subscriptions in 10 years. Do I really care? No, these things go up and down over time. Isn't that interesting? What is it about that? Unsubscribe, brake lights, best go around some of these things we would rather not wrestle with. Now, Julie sent me a story a little while ago. Thank you, Julie. It was an illustration, a story of something. And she thought, you're a preacher, you might have use for this. And today's the day, so here it is. Where they created, scientists created this biosphere and for the ideal growing environment for trees and shrubs and such. And what they found in this, quote-unquote, ideal growing environment is that trees grew quickly, but they fell easily. Grew quickly, fell easily. Now, why is that? Because in this, quote-unquote, perfect environment, there was no wind. And so because there was no wind, the roots of the trees didn't go down very deeply. Right? Apparently, it's to do with the wind somewhat. When there's wind and resistance and the trees have to deal with that, then the roots go down deeper into the soil. Well, we as people are kind of like trees. Not in all ways, obviously, but in some ways. The idea, it's only with a bit of turbulence, some of the, quote, winds of life, some of the adversity, some of the difficult things that we deal with, only then really is it when our roots grow deeper and we become more mature and stronger to handle some of the things that life throws our way. And so today's text is challenging. It's not politically correct. We see flashing lights, so to speak, but it is an opportunity for our minds to strengthen and the roots of our faith to grow deeper. This is in the context of our current teaching series on 1st and 2nd Peter. It's called Rocky. This is the fisherman turned apostle, and he is writing in the early 60s in the first century under the oppressive Roman rule, and he's writing to Christians who feel like exiles. They feel like strangers in their own communities, in their own countries. Writing to a place called Asia Minor, and this is a variety of provinces, but today it's what we would call Turkey. And he's really writing to them in the context of them experiencing more and more persecution because of their faith. And so he's telling them to have hope and to keep persevering despite the adversity that they are going through. And so in today's section of text, probably the most difficult, certainly the most politically incorrect through the entire series, he will speak about honoring the emperor, who is a bloodthirsty tyrant and who Peter knows is a bloodthirsty tyrant. He will talk about the posture of slaves to masters and the relationship between husbands and wives to husbands. So we're going to begin the text at 1 Peter 2, chapter 13, and we're going to read to chapter 3, verse 7. We're going to go through the text. We're going to explain it. We're going to explain some background. There will be things that you maybe anticipate, some things that you never anticipated before, and some of you might see some of these passages in a new way. Verse 13, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. Now we're going to start right there, because this is kind of like a theme verse that kind of sets the tone for three sections of text that Peter is going to teach in the words that follow. Be subject to. Now, this is important. We're going to come back to this. Originally, it was a military term, to rank under, to place under command of. So military order, okay? And then he says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. So this is really critical because this is at the heart of Paul's overarching approach through these challenging passages, okay? And we're going to put up on the screen, and I'll repeat it a couple of times. In an increasingly hostile environment to their faith, followers of Jesus are to work within existing structures where possible, notice the brackets, where possible, while adopting an attitude that glorifies God and exemplifies his honor and goodness to others, okay? Now, does this mean blind obedience? No, it does not. Notice the brackets, where possible. Now, how do we know this? Well, because we're told throughout Scripture that we're always to put God first, right? Not only that, but in Acts chapter 5, we have a situation with this same person, this same author, Peter, right? The story of the early apostles is recorded in the book of Acts and elsewhere, where Peter, he's come up against this hostility with the governing authorities because he's preaching the name of Jesus. And what does Peter say in Acts chapter 5, verse 29? We must obey God rather than men, right? So clearly there are situations where the ways that you honor God need to trump some of these other human relationships. Continuing, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. So that this isn't just theoretical, let's put this in a real specific historical situation. Who was the Roman emperor at this time? At this time, it was Nero who reigned from 54 to 68 AD. So Peter was most likely killed and martyred under this same emperor a few years later. Okay, he was crucified. Was he crucified vertically or upside down? We're not totally sure. One early source says upside down. Nevertheless, he's martyred under the same guy. Now get this. In the year 64, which is only probably a couple years from the writing of this letter, there's a fire in Rome. There's this big fire, and Nero is coming under criticism. Some think that the emperor himself started it. Anyway, he blames a specific group of people, perhaps as a scapegoat. He blames the Christians. And what does he do? He gathers up some Christians, and he puts them on poles in his garden, and he sets them aflame. He uses them as human torches for some of his parties and his feasts. Here's a kind of a well-known picture. It was by Henrik Shimaradzki. And if you notice on the right side, there's some tall poles. There's people wrapped in something, and they're getting set ablaze. That is what has happened. We have this from historical sources outside the Bible. This is the same emperor that Peter is saying we should be subject to where possible. Where possible. Verse 15, for this is the will of God, what? Here, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Now, in the ancient world, rulers expected obedience from subjects in many ways, including in some situations that they would adopt their faith and their religion. So you need to be honoring the emperor in those ways. You need to be offering the pagan sacrifices. Peter is saying to keep living as servants of God, which will show others God's goodness. So our example, even in the midst of tyrannical situations, should be such that other people can see how we are living and glorify the true God. Verse 17, honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Those are some pretty succinct statements. Brotherhood, this means the fellowship of the church, both men and women. So he uses the word honor twice there, so we should probably define what it is. Here's a definition of the word honor. In Greek, it's tamao, ascribing worth to someone, honor, revere, respect. This is the sense. So the surprising part of this verse would be that even the punitive and bloodthirsty emperor should be shown honor where possible. Second section of text. Let's continue verse 18. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust, meaning the unjust masters. For this is a gracious thing when, mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if, when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if, when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. Okay, so remember Peter's overarching logic. And I put it up there again, let's be reminded of it. In an increasingly hostile environment to their faith, followers of Jesus are to work within existing structures where possible, while adopting an attitude that glorifies God and exemplifies his honor and goodness to others. Now, to understand and unpack what's really going on here, we need to understand that what is going on in the first century under the Roman Empire is somewhat different in terms of slaves and masters, what we think today here in North America when we think slaves and masters. Because what do we think? We immediately go to what do we know the most? We know the North American experience of slavery, which was race-based. That's what we think about, okay? So let me highlight a couple of differences. First of all, in the ancient world, it was not race-based as it was in the North American experience. Anyone could be a slave regardless of background. Okay? This was a major part of the ancient world. There were millions of slaves in the Roman Empire. Some historians say 10 to 20%. So one historian who even said up to 30% of the population are slaves. It's a major part of the ancient world. Anyone could be a slave. Many Greek doctors were technically slaves. Now, most slaves became slaves because of one of three reasons, and the first was war. So you get captured in a war, you become a prisoner, you can become enslaved. The second is because so many people were slaves, many people were born into it. Makes sense. You're in a household, your family are slaves or servants, you get born into it. The third was through volunteering. And there were people who volunteered to be slaves. Maybe they're close to the poverty line, maybe there's some challenges in their life, and so by signing up for slavery, they could have a place to stay, they could have food to eat. Some people volunteered to be slaves to pay off debts, right? It's not like there's a intricate banking system back then like there was now. Most slaves would go free by the time they were 30. Some, in some situations, chose to stay because the situation was better for them, or maybe they had responsibilities. Some households could provide education, and in some cases, they actually became very attached to their families. But nevertheless, even though, so what I'm describing in the first century experience was very different than what we understand from more modern North American slavery, I don't want to give the impression that it's all great, because it wasn't. There were many challenges and dangers. For example, heads of household could kill slaves. Women were especially vulnerable, especially to sexual exploitation. And men could often be sold as gladiators, and of course, they would be killed in a gruesome, quick fashion. Now, a controversial issue here is verse 20, verse B. But if, when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. Now, people ask, does this mean that God thinks that it is a good thing when people are beaten and suffer? That's not what Peter says. It's specifically not what he says. The idea here is that when you do good, you are seeking to do good and you suffer, God sees your grace in the midst of your suffering. He sees you. He sees your grace despite the pain that you are enduring. And he continues with this theme in verse 21. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself, meaning Christ, bore our sins in his body on the tree, that's a euphemism for the cross, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed, for you were straying like sheep, but now have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. So in this section of text, we need to keep in mind that slaves are often given little value. So they're in this difficult situation. They're often given little value. And Peter ascribes to them value and worth and says that they're suffering, in their suffering, when they do good, they're actually being like Jesus, who also suffered, though he did no wrong. And so I think there's a pastoral tone here, is that as people are enduring these situations, he's actually encouraging them. Imagine how encouraging it would have been to a slave to hear that they share in the dignity of Christ. In a world that in many ways does not value them, they actually share in the dignity of Christ. And Peter is so familiar with the Old Testament, he brings in several verses from Isaiah 53 to do so. Now, what comes next is perhaps the most controversial of 1 Peter, but it's interesting for reasons I'll explain shortly. They would have thought it was controversial too in the first century, but reasons that are different than ours. They would have been offended, I think, for what it said about men. We are offended for what it says about wives. And so we're going to unpack this a little bit, and then I'll explain why that difference. Chapter 3, verse 1. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, meaning even if some husbands do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, whether they see, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Okay, so a couple of things. Remember Peter's overarching intent. In an increasingly hostile environment to their faith, followers of Jesus are to work within existing structures where possible, while adopting an attitude that glorifies God and exemplifies his honor and his goodness to others. Okay, so earlier when we looked at that phrase, be subject to, I quoted Norman Hillier, who said that really this is a military term of order, a military term of order. So think of an actual chain of command in an army. Okay, so everyone has different abilities. Everyone has different intel that they bring to the battle, right? The context is a battle. And everyone brings this intel and everyone is working together. But at one point, if you have two people at the top of the chain command who are kind of at loggerheads all the time, that is not really going to help the battle and the army at large. And so the idea is there is this loving order where a man is the head of the household, just as Christ is the head of the church. So we see that logic actually in Ephesians 5, where the Apostle Paul says that same thing. Wives subject to husbands, as Christ is head of the church, so a husband is head of the household. And so in this sense, there's actually a cooperative yielding. And again, think that military kind of order of command structure is helpful. Everyone's bringing intel. Everyone's bringing gifts and abilities. Hebrew language scholar Robert Alter, when he looks at the language that is used in the Hebrew back in the book of Genesis between Adam and Eve, he says, the wording for Eve isn't helper is too weak. The word that is used is much stronger, like a right-hand man, or in this case, a right-hand woman in a military context, someone who is with others in the context of battle. So it's a cooperative yielding in the order of loving command for the unity of the household who is in some sort of spiritual battle. Now, Peter goes on to say, even if some do not obey the word. So clearly there's a context where there's some believing wives and some unbelieving husbands. And again, there are some crossovers with today, but not totally. So today we read this and say, well, some of the husbands were sitting at home on the couch, twiddling their thumbs. They're atheists. Well, it's not really the case in the ancient world. Most people are quite religious. They're just religious in different ways. So the context here is probably these men are not worshiping the one true God. But what they're doing is they're still engaging in the false pagan worship and offering those sacrifices in the temple. And the idea is that they may be one without a word. So does this mean that women can't say anything? No, it doesn't mean that, because we know from other passages that there are times, many times, where it's appropriate to talk about and share your faith. The idea here is that the pressure isn't all on that, because being an example of the grace and truth of God actually does make a difference in the lives of many husbands. Continuing, verse 3, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. Notice it's a small L. It's more like sir. This is from Genesis 18. And you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. Now, he starts this section by talking about the braiding of hair and gold jewelry. If you came to church with braiding in your hair and a gold necklace, fear not. Okay, this is not really what you think it means. So what we've been doing is we've been trying to look at contextually and historically what is actually happening. Okay. These words in context referred to an elaborate and expensive habit among the wealthy to nearly totally cover the hair with gold spangles in a braided fashion, so most of the hair was not seen, in kind of a crown-like design that raised a few inches above the head. So it's incredibly elaborate, expensive, and it's meant to draw attention to yourself. So based on the words that are using, that is specifically what is being described here. So it's about drawing attention to yourself in all the wrong ways. And today we might add wearing clothing, which is clearly something which is immodest. You know, there's this trend of very short shorts where like someone's backside is hanging out the shorts. Like that would be in this category, right? Let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart. The focus is on internal beauty and modesty. He goes on to talk about a gentle and quiet spirit, i.e. not argumentative, right? Verse 7, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So a couple of things. The husband actually has the moral responsibility to be understanding toward the wife and to show her honor. And remember earlier I said that people would have kind of been upset by this passage, but in the first century those reasons would be very different than our reasons today. Well, this is why. Because I believe that women in the first century were reading things like this. They're like, yep, 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 all that makes sense. But all of a sudden, it's the men, I think, in original context, who actually would have been a bit more upset or at least surprised by this context. Now, why is that? It's because men in the ancient world, in their households, could basically do anything they want. They didn't have a moral responsibility to their wives. And in fact, women had very few legal rights. And so all of a sudden, this is actually moral responsibility put on the men. And this is what would have been shocking to first century readers, not what it said about women. He goes on to talk about women as the weaker vessel. Now, I want to pause on this for a second because this is a situation where I honestly believe that we have become so conditioned by political correctness that we see something like this and we start to froth at the mouth and we forget what it actually means. This is about physical weakness, okay? Now, it is observable and measurable that men, on average, are physically stronger than women. That's why we have different sports, etc. Men are different spiritually in some ways. We have different mental emotional differences. We're different physically and biologically, etc. And so on average, men are physically stronger than women. So we need to play this out to hear what Peter's really saying. I was talking about this around the dinner table this week with Laura, and she's like, well, yeah, that's obvious. You should just invite me up to the front, and we should have an arm wrestle, and you can just show it. Laura, come on down. Just joking. But to be a bit more serious, over the years, I've had many women come up to say to me, you don't know what it's like as a man to walk at night outside. And they're right. I don't know. And I've never had a man say that to me. I've only had women. They are acknowledging in a very honest moment that there are times when they feel physically vulnerable in a world that has many men in it. That's just the honest truth. And so what is happening here? What's happening here is that we are actually learning something about the moral responsibility of men. You are to understand your wives. You are to honor them. And what Paul says in Ephesians 5 is you are to love your wives as Christ loved the church. And acknowledging that women are often physically not as strong as men, he's appealing to them as providers and protectors. You need to take care of the women. So we hear this today and we freak out, but this is actually coming from a place of love. You need to understand, you need to honor, you're physically stronger. Your job is to take care of them. And we see that bear out in the next couple of verses. He calls them heirs with you. Wives are equal in value and in worth and will inherit eternity right alongside their believing husbands. And then we learn that you have to do this so that your prayers might not be hindered. In other words, if men mistreat their wives, their prayers before the Lord become less effective. If I dishonor Laura, my prayers for her and my children become weaker and less effective. I pray for you as a congregation every day. If I dishonor Laura, my prayers for you become weaker, okay? They become less effective. Now, before moving on to our application, it needs to be said that none of this allows for a situation of mistreatment or abuse. None. We need to be very clear on that. In fact, there are biblical grounds for divorce. And I won't get into all the references specifically, But if you want them, I'm happy to share them with you later. But let me highlight four of them. Adultery is biblical grounds for divorce. So is emotional and physical neglect. So is spiritual incompatibility. So is abandonment and abuse. These are biblical grounds for divorce. And the reason it's important to say this is because when you go through the Bible, it's very clear about what marriage is. We cannot tamper with that. Okay? It's very clear about what it is. But when there has been mistreatment, when there has been clear abuse, there is a provision for what is called a certificate of divorce for the offended party, for the victim, so that they can be freed if they choose, and to remarry if that is their desire. So what we find is that the Bible is very firm on what marriage is, and at the same time, it is pastoral and realistic to victims when things have gone off the rails. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. So earlier I mentioned the ideal biosphere, remember that? Where trees grow quickly and they fall easily. Well, like trees, humans need to be challenged in order to deepen their roots and become stronger. And I really do think, friends, today, these are tough passages. I really think that today, and like whenever we wrestle with tough passages like this, that's exactly what's happening. We're dealing with some sort of resistance to ideas or thoughts or things we have heard or things we have wondered ourselves or experienced. And that is a process of our own roots becoming deeper into the earth. And if we don't do this kind of work, what happens when we take the off-ramp blinkers and simply go around these passages? What happens when someone challenges us about a difficult passage and we don't know what to say? Or what happens when we only rely on the Google algorithm to give us answers to difficult things and our faith and our theological understanding is only about an inch deep? What's to be done? We need to do the work. What's to be done when we don't like our political leaders? What's to be done when we don't like our coworkers? What's to be done when we are in a married and are in a difficult situation and it's painful? One way to summarize Peter's overarching ethic is to choose honor. What Peter says in verse 17, honor everyone where possible. Remember Peter's overarching approach. In an increasingly hostile environment to their faith, followers of Jesus are to work within existing structures where possible, while adopting an attitude that glorifies God and exemplifies his honor and goodness to others. Choose honor. And here's our definition. Ascribing worth to someone. Honor, revere, respect. And the word choose is really deliberate. We need to choose honor, especially in this world that thrives on disrespect. It thrives on people having power plays over one another. It thrives on everyone wanting to be right. We need to choose it. We need to decide to show honor to other people. And when we do so, we are cooperating with a way of life that glorifies God and which exemplifies his honor and goodness to others. Tim Keller says that a sailboat moves swiftly because the sailor honors its design. Think of the rudder. Think of the mast. Think of all the things. A sailboat goes smoothly when the sailor honors its design. And soon as we don't honor that design, no matter who it is, no matter what their responsibility within the relationship, within the institution of which they are a part, things go sideways. Keller observes, in the same way, humans thrive in certain environments and break down in others. They thrive in certain environments and break down in others. May we honor the people around us according to the word and will of God. Praise of God. Choose honor.